Downloads of this show are available on Podomatic.com and the Podomatic mobile app.
It's 7 o'clock. You're listening to Radio Free Brooklyn. You know what that means. It's time for Here Now with Rachel C. I'm your host, Rachel C. Joining me in the studio tonight is bestselling author and musician Nick Fowler. We're going to kick things off tonight with a little something-something from our friend Emma DeCourcy from I Am the Polish Army. She's got a solo project out right now. This is Gold. Alrighty, everybody. Thanks for tuning in on this snowy, at least in Brooklyn. Well, you can still call it snowy. It's just a bit wet and damp. Evening in Brooklyn. This is Here Now with Rachel C., the show where we celebrate live performance, culture, and activism in the arts. Thank you for tuning in to Radio Free Brooklyn, the independent, free-form, farm-to-table, independent small batch artisanal internet radio station. I'd like to, I'm reminding you of that at this time, because I'd also like to remind you at the top of the hour now about a little project we've been working on. It's our after-school program. Radio Free Brooklyn is very proud to announce that we are launching an after-school program for local teenagers in 2019 to learn media literacy through media making using a hands-on approach guided by local professionals. If you are interested in participating or donating in this program, please go to radiofreebrooklyn.org/afterschool. Remember, these donations are tax deductible. Basically, what this is, local teens will be participating in this program. There will be a concise curriculum, which is taught and conducted by local professionals from start to finish. You want to learn how to actually build and make a radio show or a podcast. This is where teens will go to do that, and we'll. The curriculum will conclude with an actual broadcast that will stream on a live stream dedicated, something that is kind of like a side stream, if you will, to Radio Free Brooklyn. There will be something tangible, that a product that is tangible product that is streaming live on a sister stream, kind of like our local Chords network. I'm not wording this very well right now, but there will be a tangible show that the teens will produce as a result of going through this program that will stream live on kind of a sister stream in RFB. But when we did receive a grant for this, but we're a little shy. If you'd like to help contribute to that, go right on ahead. I also encourage you to listen to us on the go. RadioFreeBrooklyn.org/iPhone, RadioFreeBrooklyn.org/Android. Those are the apps to listen to us on the go. Sound quality is actually quite good. I'm not just saying that. I've listened to them. They are excellent. Also, this is Here and Now, where we celebrate live performance culture. I like you to go out and see and do things. So I'm going to tell you about things to go out and see and do. Tomorrow, Friday, November 16th, LUST, an alternative Thanksgiving feast. That is happening at Lot 45 in Brooklyn. Tickets are available on Eventbrite. LUST is not just an event, it is kind of a community. So I invite you to go check out LUST on the social media channels. Find out more about that event. Also, this Saturday, the Sus album release event is happening at the Park Church Co-op at 7 p.m., 129 Russell Street in Brooklyn. Go check that out. I'm going to leave you right now with a little bit of music from the Black Angels. Okay. Welcome back to Here and Now with Rachel C. Ooh, that was a little hot. That's okay then. Thank you for tuning in to Radio Free Brooklyn on this snowy evening. My guest tonight is Nick Fowler. Thank you for joining me in the studio tonight, Nick.
Thanks for having me, Rachel.
Thanks for being here. Well, you're here. We're here largely to celebrate the publication of your latest novel, but man, what a career you've had. I'm really thrilled to have you in the studio here today. Your latest novel is...
And that's coming out, and it's not out yet, I should say. It's coming out August 1st, 2019.
So we're a little bit ahead of time, but like but I feel
pre-orders,
like...
pre-orders, I think, so...
They're pre-ordering that far ahead of time now, though.
Yeah.
I mean, that's impressive, because... Especially for books, but I'm impressive in a good way, because I feel like I keep hearing, like... I hear, like, whispers of, like, oh, print is... Are people reading? Are they? But
is it like, gone? Is
print gone? It can't be if people are pre-ordering that far ahead of time.
Yeah, I think they still want the book, the smell of the
smell of the book. They want to turn the page. Yeah, they want to, you know, they want that, and that's a good thing. I'm really happy about that.
Yeah.
This is not your first book. Not by a long shot.
Although I've written a lot that are still in the vault.
you've written quite a bit over the years. You're probably best known as a musician, and I mean, going back many, you've had a career going back many years. Sorry, that wasn't like notation or anything, but you've collaborated with. I mean, where do I even start? Going back to the '90s, you've been working professionally for many years. You've been on the Tonight Show. You've collaborated with many renowned musicians. I do my homework, folks. You can tell us a little bit about yourself, but you're originally from, it seems like you're originally from Florida, went to Cornell.
Yes.
And kind of once you were in New York, although Cornell isn't quite New York City, close enough, things kind of took off from there. But did you go to Cornell to study writing or to study music? Because it seems like once you tried either or, you really found success in both writing and in music.
I went there, I just think, grew up there partially. I was born in Germany, and then my family, we quickly moved to Ithaca. And I fell in love with Ithaca as a little kid. And then when I realized that I could go to college there, I said I was going to do that. So I went to Cornell, magical place, you know. The literary history there is huge. Nabokov taught there, and Thomas Pynchon went there, and Richard Farina. So there was that legacy, and I think I was... eager to participate in that. And then it was there that I was in my first bands, rock and roll bands. I, you know, kind of supported myself, you know, spending money from the frat parties we'd play. And I was talking about, I met my friend Jesse Harris there. He wrote that song for Norah Jones, that huge hit. What's the name of that song?
I don't know why I didn't come.
Yes.
Can I just pause to highlight?
Sure.
I went to college and supported myself spending money playing music.
It wasn't quick either. I mean, freshman and sophomore year, I didn't. I was desperately trying to find a band. And then finally, this junior year, I found a band and I started with...
It's a little magical.
It wasn't a lot of money. It was enough, though. It was cool to be able to, you know...
It's a little magical there. Like, yeah, I kind of was able to do this, like doing something
that. Definitely.
Yeah.
It was a wonderful feeling to earn money doing that. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay, so it's kind of sort of like, you know, you kind of like figured out, you were trying to get back to where the kind of the place you loved as a kid, though, and you figured out how to do that, like through study and stuff.
Place I loved,
yeah.
Yes, but it wasn't, I was very depressed there because there's no sun. So I had to adapt to that. Yeah, so that was hard. It was like being in Sweden.
Yeah.
Overcast Ithaca. Yeah.
Ithaca is beautiful, but man, talk about, I mean, I having been there and... haven't been to Florida, but knowing what Florida is like from description is,
you know, it's dire. It's very
dark. It's kind of like the weather here in New York. Last week it was 65, and now it's snowing in 23.
Is it 23?
It was this morning. Yeah.
Yeah, it's horrible.
So anyway, so you've managed to find yourself back in Ithaca, and you found yourself in the company, clearly, of very talented musicians.
Where was that?
Back in Ithaca, in college.
Yes, in college, my friends Mike Unger and Seth Gold and David Huffman and Dave Siegel and Irene. There was like a big group of us that were obsessed with music. And yeah, Ithaca was known for having, you know, a lot of those bands like Blues Traveler would play there a lot, and Spin Doctors and Milk. And there was a whole heritage there in Ithaca, and Peter, Paul, and Mary. Had,
Well, the college scene, if you will, that we call it the college scene, but through the 90s was really rich. Like, if college radio was really rich.
That's when
still
it exploded. Yeah, REM was huge, and they were really, actually, U2 was a college radio band.
Yeah, and REM was really groundbreaking bands, or genre-bending and breaking bands were kind of, it was through college radio and the college scene.
That's right, Athens was a big college.
Yeah, could do that then. And so you're there, and that's kind of, it seems like that kind of really opened up a lot of doors. So from there, you're there in college, and so as we were saying, so you're there for music, and so it's so, okay. Were you studying literature, and music sort of happened, or was it
I was writing a novel, and mm-hmm. I remember I was a study, you know, I was a creative writing major, and I was writing this novel, and then I finished the book, and I thought that it was like going to be the big book, you know, mm-hmm. I was convinced because the big books of that summer were Mysteries of Pittsburgh by Michael Chabon, and Brightless Big City had been a few years before, so I wanted to be like the next McInerney, the next Michael Chabon. So I wrote this book, and it was almost published, but I made the mistake of dating the girl at the publishing place. One of the stupidest, okay. stupidest things I did.
Oopsies.
So that didn't work. And then I sort of got involved in music and didn't remember the book, and then wrote a different book later when the girl broke my heart, who I was.
Okay, but clearly one book went somewhere because you're known, you know, it's you had a book that went that was published with some acclaim. Which book was it that?
No, that was a thing or two about Curtis and Camilla. That was published. The paperback came out 2003, I think.
Okay, which book was that? Was that the one you wrote? Well, after you dated the girl at the publishing
right.
company,
which so,
I'm curious,
yeah.
which novel was it? Because like I'm wondering, is this a situation where like I don't know if are you someone who has a lot of things, projects going on simultaneously, and some of them get finished or not?
Exactly.
Or, yeah.
Exactly that person. Are you that person?
Yeah.
It's like, you know, you have all these things.
18 open file cabinets
right, exactly.
constantly.
Yes.
Which file cabinet got closed? Which one was it?
but it's like you have to try them all because 10% of them will fly. You know, 90 won't.
90 won't. Yeah. But well, I'm just out of curiosity. Which file cabinet was that? Was that the one that like which novel was that got
so
published?
I was writing this book and I remember it was like. It was all these good perceptions kind of, but they were like graffiti. It wasn't really strung through with any kind of coherent, cohesive principle. And then this girl dumped me and I was like, oh, now I know what I'm going to write about.
Oh, wait. Okay.
So I just sort of, all the notes sort of cohered magnetically, like centripetally. They suddenly worked in light of, so I was able to take all these notes and sort of made them, they electromagnetically threw themselves towards the core of this heartbreak.
Yeah, so you kind of needed a big enough blow, like a big enough blow to the ego to kind of go, oh, this is devastating.
Exactly.
Enough.
I stopped. That was what it was. I stopped writing the book about myself, and I started writing about this girl. And that was it. It gave
wow.
me such a freedom, you know.
Yeah. Well, interesting. Like, you know, so, something bad enough happened to me that I could write about something else.
No, that's the great thing about tragedy is that it removes us from our tyranny of our own ego, I think.
Interesting. Wow. Interesting way to put it. But yeah, interesting perspective. So you're at Cornell and it's an interesting way you're describing how you've wound up where you are at your life at this point. Like, this is where I was when I was young. And I just kind of wanted to go back there. And it's kind of like put you in the company of some incredible talent and incredible people who kind of like put you in this place that led you to some places, but actually wound up leading you to write this book that does really well, even though you're kind of, you're thinking.
Well, that
probably,
was the thing. I was so frustrated with the music business. I was
like, I'm a musician, but I'm frustrated, but I wound up writing this great book.
Yeah. And of course it seems, you know, it's bittersweet, I guess. But yeah, I was dating this girl at the time and she was in the music business. She was working for this powerful music attorney. And like, I was like, well, why can't you like give him my music? And she was like, I think once she was like, well, you're 30. Oh, I was 32. And she was like, they want like, you know, teenagers at this point.
Yeah.
And I was like, oh no, what do I do now? Like, well, how do I break through creatively? So then I wrote the book about this struggling musician who was like mm-hmm. aging. I made good of it.
Yeah. Is it, do you feel like you were kind of a musician who was accidentally a writer, or the other way around? Or is it equal?
You know, everybody.
Or is it like, why do we have to choose?
I love both things. I always love to write, and I always love to sing.
You don't really have to be one or the other.
No, I don't think it has to.
Yeah.
Look at Timberlake, Justin Timberlake. He's a great actor. He's a great singer. He's a great dancer. He's a great guitarist. He's a great keyboardist. He's a producer. I mean, look at Elon Musk. Mm-hmm. He does it all.
Yeah. How many artists have I come on this, have I had on the show even as an example, who said like, well, I started doing this and then I realized, hey, with this thing that I do, it can kind of manifest as this thing over here. Like the story that I told on the stage, I could write it down and then it's a book, or then I, you know, or we can add a visual and it's a movie. And then it's, if, as an example, you know,
that's the great thing about the internet.
It's art, you know, it's a story, you know,
it's a narrative. If it's a narrative, you find a place for it.
It's a narrative. It's an excellent point. But on that, because we hear Nick on the guitar right now. On that note, before we get any further into the hour, was there any, so you had the book, was there any music inspired by the Mugrid, by that particular book that you wrote? Or did the book inspire any new, how did your music inspire the book, or did the book inspire any music? Did it work kind of like that?
Yeah, I remember I wrote a bunch of songs, you know, weepy kind of, self-portraits about how bummed I was. And I think there was one good one that I got out of it. Road to Somewhere, I think, was because it was kind of wry and the lyrics were kind of self-mocking. I always think that, you know, humor is the best, most effective way to empathy. So, yeah, I wrote that song through Road to Somewhere, if you want to check it out on my Spotify and all that stuff.
Okay, you had a little something prepared for us tonight.
Yeah, right? So I'm going to play now a song that I wrote, and this song is sort of a counterpart to the novel that's coming out, which is called My Virtuous Sister. The girl in the novel is a heroin addict, and this song is called Heroin Girl, and I kind of wrote them about the same girl, and the girl's name is Petty Smout. I made her up, but she's from Wales. And I remember people were saying to me, like, my father's always been so discouraging of my writing. He said, you can't write a book about whales. But it gave me that kind of freedom, that fairy tale freedom of the fantasy. Like, I didn't know about it, but I was allowed to, like, let my characters do weird things in that fantasy space. Anyway, it's called Heroin Girl, and it appears on the Upper Hand Press website next to the book copy.
Great. This is Heroin Girl.
She sighed tears for fresh fame, another runaway. Vague dreams of the runway. As her umbrella collapses, she cries, or is it laughter? Because they feel the same. I'm a heroin girl. How can I love someone who doesn't love the world? She's my heroin girl. How can I love someone who doesn't love the world? She swears she'll change her ways. She drifts to LA. She heard they don't need seasons there. 'Cause New York City winter be just like a splinter. Yeah, it's a razor blade. She's my heroin girl. How can I love someone who doesn't love the world? She's my heroin girl. Can I love someone who doesn't love the world? She hates herself in the mirror. Tells herself to get clean or die. She's the walking dead. She's dead. She's dead. She's dead.
Wow. That's incredible. That is kind of like, for me, listening to that, it almost feels like I'm listening to the life of someone who's a little bit, it's like listening to the life of someone who's addicted a little bit.
Addicted?
Yeah, like with the abrupt ending, like in that sense.
Yeah, that's cool.
That's like, what I meant by that.
You mean like they overdosed?
Yeah, the abrupt ending, the emoting, the in the abrupt ending and that. Yeah.
Yeah, that's a song. I mean, I think heroin was such a problem in the past in New York, but I don't know. Is it still like that?
I think
the designer drugs have replaced that.
Designer drugs with similar effects on the brain.
Like, you know, Molly is a big one.
Well,
now.
Yeah.
Yeah, right.
Well, addiction is still.
Addiction is addiction,
yeah,
right?
Yeah. But it's interesting. I think you were kind of really like, it's a very powerful song, is what I'm saying.
Thank you.
Listening to Here and Now with Rachel C. on Radio Free Brooklyn. Just a quick reminder, if you miss any of tonight's broadcast or you just want to hear the whole thing all over again, tune in Sunday at 9 a.m. Eastern. Nick Fowler is our guest tonight. Thank you for being with us tonight. So, Nick, you've been, we talked about how you kind of found yourself in an interesting time and place in the music industry as you were kind of like developing your skills as a musician and kind of suddenly found yourself a novelist. And you've been active as a working musician for so long. We were talking a little bit as we were prepping for the show, before the show, about how the industry has changed. And one thing that came up in our conversation, which I think would be interesting to talk about on the air, is how how people consume music has changed and what that means for artists. We were talking about like, hey, you know, how do we find our music now and how different that is now. And that seems to be like one of the striking differences then and now. And as someone who has worked with, I mean, so many different acclaimed musicians, like, how do you find that that's one of the biggest differences then and now?
Yeah, like how, I mean, you know, I don't know.
Because you're someone who's been on more of the better known radio stations. If you look at Nick Fowler's CV, everyone, you name a well-known radio station, well-known television show, you know. Nick's there. you know, it's, but things are a little bit different now. How do you feel this has affected, has this affected your process at all in terms of how you're making music or produce? Has it affected how you actually like write and sit down and produce, or is it more just like how you kind of put it out there?
I think that people who write songs always just sort of, I always just write with an acoustic guitar. And I, you know, people that write on the keyboard, I think that the personal writing process probably does not change for most. But yeah, the distribution is something that we're always trying to wrestle with because the platforms are always changing so quickly. So one day, you know, MySpace was a favorite platform of mine and that's gone.
Right.
And I think who bought that?
I think Jared Leto
bought it or something.
I think so.
But anyway, yeah. So the platforms are constantly evolving, so it's hard to keep track.
Right. It's almost for people who are professionals, it's hard to keep track of it. Musicians I speak with, it's kind of what they prefer, and that's what they'll use in order to stay on top of. And it's kind of that change. So I'm curious. So you wrote My Virtuous Sister. Did you write that because you felt you had kind of a story to tell, or was it just sort of like, hey, or did an opportunity present itself, or was it just kind of like, well, music is a little more challenging in terms of distribution, and so I need something easier. I mean, I can't imagine like putting a novel out is easier than putting music out, but is it just like, you know, it's just like, hey, I got to get back in more into writing, or like well, what kind no. of
so like, I was writing this. I worked on this book forever. So I was writing it. Basically, it was sort of about myself, but it was about a girl that I could write about really myself through the girl, because uh-huh. I've often felt more like a girl anyway, emotionally. So I sort of resonated with this female rock star, and I could hide behind her in a way and not say what I had been personally through in the music business. So I started, it just came pretty easily. And then I had a deal where it was going to be published, and then publisher wanted more of something, and then I wrote too much of that. She wanted more of the brother who tells the story, and then I kind of overloaded on that. And then another publisher was interested, and then she didn't like it after she wanted me to do something different, and she didn't like it. And then I just kept, you know, kept at writing the book and realized what the things were that were turning people off to it, you know, because it's just a craft like anything else. And so when I felt that I had nailed it better, I contacted Ann Starr, who's just the nicest, most intelligent, intuitive literature lover, like really a purist, who has this press, Upper Hand Press. And she was really seemed to like it, and she had a lot of ideas, and we just worked well and together and edited it down to where it is now.
It sounds like you were telling, had a story to tell, and you were kind of writing it like outside of your typical gender normative storytelling, and that might have been like, which I think really has a wonderful place here and now, and but might have been kind of intimidating for some of the people writing it, or reading it rather, and might have been or just kind of like so outside the box of what the people who are reading it are used to
it's
reading.
Very sexy too. I wanted to write about a girl who was sleeping with a lot of men. There was a girl, I won't name her, but I dated her, and she basically got her name above. She became a big star in the music business by sleeping with everybody. And she told me she was going to do it, and then she did it. And I thought that was like, I mean, there's obviously flaws to doing it, but I thought it was sort of cool that she said about doing it and did it.
But you're kind of saying like, I kind of like, I'm a guy, and you just said like, I'm a guy, but I don't always feel like it. But you're kind of like, well, I'm kind of breaking down like, I'm writing of something like not, I'm kind of coming from like, I'm doing something not gender conforming. Just
yeah,
the way
I wanted to
the
get
words
out of
I'm
that
using.
Box because, yeah. yeah.
So you kind of did something that was like non gender conforming. And I think that was kind of breaking some barriers there that might have been kind of intimidating for, or just not what people who were going to sit down and read it were expecting. So, which I think is kind of timely right now in a good way. But it might have been kind of challenging for you as a writer, but in a good way. I'm glad you did it.
I feel like I wrote more easily as a girl than I did as a guy. Actually, it was fun. I was like, I saw men for what they're kind of like more. So I was sort of made me feel I had a new love and respect for women after writing it. I think.
Good for you, man. Look, I mean, in a good way. I mean, I feel like you were kind of nowhere.
Sounds really
social,
bitter, I guess.
No. I think sociocultural, like, we're kind of at a point where it's like, hey, we're kind of talking about gender roles and like, but in a bigger, broader way, and how we can kind of see outside our own, like, hey, let's take it from somebody else's perspective. Like, if I'm a guy, like, let's take it from the female perspective.
All have dimensions of the other.
If I'm the other, if I'm a woman, let me try and like, say like see or write from the male perspective, and that's what I mean by like that by that.
Exactly.
So let's try and see outside of like the perspective we're kind of socialized to, and that helps us understand the other.
And then we can get along with our mates, assuming our mates are not the same sex. Better,
right? Yeah, and just the person sitting next to us, even like let's get along with others better.
Yes, that's better.
It's always a good thing. Yeah. Okay, so you had this story to tell. And that's how the book came about. What are your hopes for the book right now? What are the plans for the book? What are the hopes? It's not due out for release until August of next year. But
I want to get like a big prize. Like I want to get. I want to show everybody. Like I've really never made. I've made some money from books, but not like the guys like you know John Grisham and those guys. So I never really thought that I was going to be able to make a lot of money. So I always wanted like the esteem. Like I just want to be. I want my book to be read by children who, it's about abuse. I would love my book to be read by children who have struggled with any kind of abuse and loneliness and that kind of feeling. And I would love the book to be read, you know, in years to come in schools. That would be the dream. I want immortality for these things. Like, I want them to be read like Gatsby. I want my book to be
legacy,
one of those big books.
And to touch,
I don't know if the one that I just wrote is good enough, but I want to eventually be read in the school, in the classroom.
You know? Yeah, to see generations to like read the words and to mean something.
Yeah, and say, look, legacy. This is what Brooklyn was like, you know, in 2018.
Nice.
This is what it was like, you know.
Right, right. What are the plans for you? So has writing this book influenced your music writing at all right now? Since
you know, it's funny you say that because I have such a good editor. Like Anne is so, she knows what works and what doesn't work. So I think it's made me more disciplined with like my craft.
Right.
I don't know if that's true.
Did you want to play anything else for us? Still kind of fiddling around.
I don't know. It's up to you. What do you think?
Whatever you want to do. We could take a little music break right now.
I should read something maybe.
You could. You have something for that's right. You have something. Let's read, because not only is he a musician, he reads. We have a little something from the book. Is this from My Virtuous Sister coming up?
Yes. Do I have a moment?
Yes, you totally have. You have many moments, Nick. We have time. Once again, you're listening to Here and Now with Rachel C. on Radio Free Brooklyn. We are a 501c3. Get your write-ups on before the end of the year. If you can't make a donation, please consider. And if you're an Amazon shopper, if you do that, you can sign up with Smile and choose RadioFreeBrooklyn.org. You could do that. We're going to hear a little something from My Virtuous Sister, which is really cool because it's not out until August of next year, you guys.
Okay. So
kill my mic.
This is the narrator is this little brother, you know, and I guess should I prep it? Okay. So the narrator is this little brother and the girl he's writing about is his big sister. You'll hear it anyway. Okay. Here it is. To my Elphick. Okay. This New Year's Eve, 2001, I decided it was high time I crawled from the metaphoric post 9/11 rubble and told you the story of my sister, Songstress Cordelia Petty Smout, as I bask here in the bar's wishful twilight at the mercy of apparently yet another prose evoking relapse, bender, retreat, venting session. An unreliable narrator has options, I suppose. Armed with my nostalgia and a fake ID amidst the festivities of McManus's Tavern on the familiar crossroads of Manhattan's 7th Avenue at 19th Street, sitting Indian style with my laptop in a bay window as I watch forgetful snow fall through a street lantern's glow, like the magical scratches on the old movies my sister and I used to watch in our bed. Diversions that these days, now that my sister seems to have permanently split the scene, keep me company through the night. My dear, my sister, my muse, my memory keeper, older than your narrator by 5 years and change, and more talented by a margin than a number of ways soon explored at the risk of putting you to sleep, forced me to abandon my initial childhood dream of playing music with Petty. And as a result, like every men's room attendant in this most literate of cities, come to fancy myself a writer, an observer, read pariah. A sister whose whereabouts would be much appreciated if you could pass them along. Petty hasn't been back home across the ocean to Mauston, Wales for quite some time now, you see. So, with the dime-bright hope that in combing her stomping grounds this Yuletide season, I might jog any and all available memories with the pertinent information and a stiff drink or two, what follows is the chronicle of a previous New Year's Eve, the last my sister was seen, 1999. An account that, due to what I believe is its hard-won wisdom, I will try to convey in as close as possible to the spirit of said sister, age 6, urging the nipple of a formula bottle into the betrayed, stubbornly shut mouth of the baby brother on hunger strike in the dusk of his crib, terrified of our father, who throughout our story shall remain without the dignity of a name.
Ow. I love how this Here and Now is came about as a show that was supposed to like be about art coming to life on the radio, and it's like books are art, books are live performance. Like it's books come alive when you read them out loud. It is Why live is performance.
Yeah.
It's once you hear the words alive in your head, books are live art. And this just happened now. It's live art. That was beautiful. Thank you. Thanks. And that really, I think that really, I'm very intrigued by all that. That was a really great, like, you know, it's really fascinating. Oh, and Nick's wife just joined us. Nick said, in addition to writing a book this year, Nick got married, right? Congratulations.
Thanks.
Rounds of applause.
Big Catholic wedding.
Big Catholic wedding.
Thank you.
Very big one. Congratulations, you guys. Yeah, it's fast. That's very, like, you know, that's very dramatic. And also, the character who, like, henceforth, he goes for the entire novel without a name, the father.
Yeah. That was Anne's idea, the publisher. She was like, really? Let's not give this prick a name.
Really?
Yeah.
Wow. Yeah. Interesting. So a lot of editing went on. Can I ask how much of, I mean, because I assume this is true of any writer, how much personal experience went into
so much
this, really?
Yes, of course. You know,
I mean, I hear a little bit of New York in there, obviously, the corner of 17th Street and
the whole
thing.
I pretty much lived the whole thing.
Really?
Yeah.
Uh-huh. Were there certain things, like personal stories, you were ready to tell with this book and not the other, and not before? Was it like, I'm wondering with the time, because you've written other things, like you had one other book where that went, like we talked about the just because we mentioned, like, you know, I said before earlier, yeah, how many file cabinets do we have, both you and I have left?
I have them right here. I have my to-do list.
You know, how many file cabinets do we have open, and like one managed to get closed, and that's the published novel? And like, what was it about? Like, it could be just by chance this file cabinet got closed because you just happen to have, like, Anne was on your side, and like, she's that good an editor and said this project is going to make a good book. Was there something about this story, or was it just like where you were in your life, you're ready to tell this parts of
the story was good, and I knew the writing was good because publishers had wanted the thing, but I'd never been able to, like, make them happy,
right?
And
right.
So I think this was just a matter of waiting for the right person, like, God wanted it to happen,
right? Yeah. So this was a story, or in a way certain stories that were ready to come together, because you're talking about China, talking about your personal experiences, and you're kind of writing the perspective of this one woman that you knew. And
I mean, I'm very religious. I just, I think if you prayed to Jesus Christ, you know, I think everything.
Yeah. It sounds like you had a lot of guidance from above and from within.
Yeah. Kind I just of try to, place, you know, I'm a bad, envious person, like all of us, you know, and I have these bad instincts, but I think if we fight them down and try to behave like Christ, you know, it's like all we can do.
Jesus was a real dude too, though.
No,
that's the thing about him.
What'd you say?
He was a real dude too, though. That's the thing about him.
But how did
he live and breathe?
How did he do both?
Well, I don't know. He had some insight that maybe the rest of us, you know,
he's my hero.
Yeah. Yes,
and I wanted to say my dog recently died. I wanted to talk about her a little bit.
You can talk about her.
Monkey Pickles McGee, you know.
He had Nick Fowler, on top of everything else, had a little dog named, get this, Monkey Pickles McGee, which is like a killer name for a dog, frankly.
And she was just like the cutest little dog. And I fell in love with her online. You know, I saw her photo. And
rescue dog.
No, not a rescue dog.
No, really.
Dog.
She wasn't really.
Yeah.
You would have thought. Like,
no, I tried to meet a few rescue dogs, and there was never any chemistry.
Really?
So I met her, and
because she was like one of those really good natured. You would
no,
have thought
she wasn't good natured.
She really.
She was vicious. No, she would attack a baby.
Really,
which I just loved this damn
dog. I did meet Monkey Pickles, and she seemed like the sweetest.
That was
good
an act.
Nature.
No, she likes girls. No, she likes women. I swear, she hates men. She will attack a male baby. She has attacked. She's completely vicious.
Wow,
she
was totally misled.
But anyway, no, I loved her. I just fell in love with this damn dog. Yeah.
So it's good that you had her, because someone needed to love that dog.
Anyway, I want to say, you know, hi to Monkey up there.
All right. Oh, Monkey. Well, you know what? Well, that is a very, you know, I think Christ-like thing to do then. Like, you love someone who needed it the most. Like, others would have, when he didn't, they
no,
say
I was
he
selfish
sat with the sinners.
Because there was
like
other dogs that needed a home more, and I chose this. Well, it was just out of looks. I love the way she looked. I have to admit. I mean, I loved her soul. She was just so cute.
Oh no,
she looked like
a
little beetle pig.
Aww.
But no, I did love her soul.
I'm sorry. I'm sorry. I'm sorry.
But she was not an easy dog.
Another one will come along. Needs a home too.
Yeah.
Who who you will love just as much and will love you.
And how's your dog doing?
She's something else, that one.
Now, her name is
Bobby Marley.
Okay.
After the man himself. Right. Bobby Marley Mayhem. We named her Bobby Marley, and the mayhem came because she was a little puppy who used to like run in circles around the apartment. Mm-hmm. I just saw her run in circles one day. I went, Marley Mayhem, and it kind of stuck. Other than just so as I want to kind of get the conversation back to the writing and the music, although somehow dogs always come into it if you're talking about books and music. I can't have a conversation with a musician without dogs coming into it.
No, they come in. They're very musical.
They really are.
Monkeys just sing when I would play. It was really cute.
Sorry about my... Is that the phone ringing? Because it rang once. I can't quite tell. So what... Musically speaking, where do you see music going for you right now? We know the plan. We talked about your plans for the book, or what you would like, aspirations for your writing and so forth and so on. Who are you collaborating with, if anyone, right now? Where is music going for you right now? Where would you
I want to do is make a video for this song, Splinter, and somehow release that in conjunction with the book. But I don't know if there's a platform. That's what I'm trying to work out now. If there's some way to promote both the book and the video somehow at the same time. So that's what I'm trying to figure out.
Okay, I'm sure there is. There's all sorts of things. Can I ask, because I know you've played so many different places with collaborators, so many different artists, before we kind of sign off for the evening. Of all the different places you've, and I ask this of all of my guests who have performed, read, toured, because we're kind of a show that celebrates live performance culture. Of all the places you've performed, played, toured, read, where are these places that stand out to you? New York versus anywhere else.
I think the funnest thing that I ever did, played, was two things. In college, when we played in our cover band, the last day, we played this big graduation party. And it was like, we were like the Guns N' Roses of Cornell. Like, Guns N' Roses had just come out. And we had this band. And anyway, that was a great time. And then when my band opened up for Bon Jovi in Toronto. Mm-hmm. And it was like one of our first gigs. And suddenly there was this, pretty much like a stadium, I guess. It was like, not a stadium maybe, but like an arena. Mm-hmm. And it was full of people, and they were crazy for Bon Jovi, and they were like happy to see anything that opened for it. So that was a great
moment. It's like so here, and we're so present and in the moment that they were just going to like love it.
Yeah, they were so nice. They were like, anything associated with Bon Jovi has to sort of be good. So they were very kind, but that was a lot of fun. That adrenaline of that was fun.
How do you find New York versus some of these other outside of New York spaces?
I mean, I think the sound in New York is always the best.
Anyone who's done New York versus
Sound systems in New York are obviously far superior to any other place that I've noticed. Just the technology and the meticulous, that LA and New York. Yeah. The Mint is probably the most sophisticated place I've ever played in America, the Mint in LA. Mm-hmm. So other than New York and LA, though, there's some good venues, but just the professionalism I don't find is ever as high. Maybe Nashville now. Mm-hmm. But, as far as the crowds, I think people outside of New York and L.A. are more friendly because they're not jaded. They're not jaded.
Yeah, I'm finding that there's a level of saturation from conversation. And even a little bit myself, just from going out and being in the places, there's an element of saturation in New York that because there's so much saturation in New York. Outside of New York, people just, there's a thing happening, man, we'll go and see it and appreciate it and respect it on a certain level because if there's something happening in town, we're going to go or we're going to love it and appreciate it on this level that's a little different.
In New York.
Yeah, outside of New York.
Outside of New York.
Because there's so much saturation in New York.
Right, you're like, whatever. Okay. You're like, Prince is playing tonight, fuck him.
Oh, Prince again?
Yeah, exactly.
But it's interesting what you're saying. It's interesting what you're saying also about the kind of the experience with certain bands like outside even big arena bands. Like you could go to a big place like Toronto. Sometimes there's kind of a vibe that follows a band with a tour. You could just even by being the opener. I asked this of everybody, but thank you for your responses. I asked that of anybody who's toured like and played in and out of New York. Can you compare the? It's interesting you threw in the technical aspect. You know, it's like for professionalism, technical, and then the kind of the crowd response.
It's always fun to play with. The sound is great, though. Even if the people don't like it, it's like if it sounds good, it's so fun.
Because it's your perspective, and then there's like there's two levels there. There's kind of like
People really can't tell by the sound mostly. Yeah. I mean, just you know, having been attuned to sound for years and years, I can hear the nuances. But most people don't really care. It's pretty good.
Uh-huh.
And that's the way it should be, because music shouldn't be refined to this kind of decimal point. But as a musician, I'm ruined by the fact that I have, you know, the bass is the preponderance of bass, as the famous line from Risky Business.
Like, remember when we had our ears to this old, like, 20-year-old amp earlier in the hour?
Yeah.
We were both like, it's okay, dude. We relate. We understand. Thank you so, so much, Nick, for being here and being a part of the show tonight.
Thanks,
Rachel. Best of luck for the book. Please keep me abreast of what is happening with your life and the career, and keep me posted of what's happening with the book. Please feel free to come back. Let me know what's been going on. We're going to end things. Please stay tuned for Frequency Theory with Tom Tenney, 8 to 10. We're going to finish things off with the hour with a little something-something from one of my faves, TV on the radio. This is Red Dress.
Hey, Jack, fuck your wall, 'cause I'm fat and in love, and the bombs are falling on me for sure. But I'm scared to death that I'm living a life not worth dying for. In your plowshare, it's a sword, and it's wide organ swing, chops the heads off of many things, monocrops, laughter or roars. Oh, how on your list.